Hello, everyone, and welcome to I Fucking Love This Movie, Episode 8. We're going to be talking about Kevin Smith, one of my all-time favorites. I mean, obviously, that's why he's an episode. I had planned on doing a Tarantino episode, but I don't think I can do Mr. Tarantino justice by myself. I'm going to need help on that episode, but I feel I can do Kevin Smith justice. Not only that, but I've been going down the Kevin Smith rabbit hole and been revisit his entire filmography and been having fun doing it. I always have fun going back and watching his movies and, you know, watching the special features, because that dude is no slouch in the bonus feature department of his movies. So that's what episode 8 is going to be about. I got a few movie reviews before we get started. First one, I had the chance to see Ty West's X. Amazing movie. It's available on stream. I don't know if it's only available to rent or rent and buy. Not too sure about that, but I know it's out. Pretty much, it's the Texas Chainsaw Massacre meets Boogie Nights. Pretty incredible film. I mean, Ty West is no slouch. He's one of the titans of horror as we speak. So check that out. My last one, the Tony Hawk documentary, Until the Wheels Fall Off. That's on HBO Max. Great, great documentary. Dude's 50 years old and still skateboards, man. The passion never died with him. Even when skateboarding kind of went through like a phase where it wasn't popular and hardly anybody was skateboarding and it wasn't lucrative, dude's still skateboarding, man. So check that one out. And those are the only two that I've really seen. So I try to watch new movies. I try to make a point to watch newer stuff. Before we get this episode started, I got two birthday shout outs. Yesterday, my buddy Jared, it was his birthday. He listens to this podcast. I got him to listen to podcasts. He came up to me at work. We worked together. We've worked together for like 15 years. That's how long we've known each other. And he's like, "Hey, man, I listen to your podcast." I was like, "You listen to podcasts?" He's like, "I listen to yours." So happy birthday, Jared. Going to see him on Saturday. I help celebrate. And on Friday, my little brother Keegan turns 25. Super proud of that dude. I had the honor and privilege of celebrating with him at his bachelor party in Nashville a few weeks ago with a bunch of his frat brothers and college buddies. I was the oldest guy of the group. It's crazy. But they didn't treat me like that. And everybody was super cool. Just a great hang. Nashville's a great city. Keegan, thank you for inviting me and not treat me like the old guy. Happy birthday, buddy. I love you. And that'll do it. Let's get into it. Episode 8, Kevin Smith.
What the fuck is the internet?
Finding an identity is a huge part of the human experience. It's a very crucial part of being a teenager. I was a fat, awkward teenager that was in concert band. I loved weird movies and music. So that's kind of where I found my solace, was in art, because art didn't judge. Art didn't care that I wasn't cool. Art didn't care that I was a fat, awkward teenager. It was a welcoming thing to me and something I still dive into to this day. When I was 13, I seen Mallrats for the first time, and it changed my life. First things first, you know, Kevin had a very John Hughes approach to his material. I didn't relate to it at the time, but I later found out I've related to it very much as an adult. And, you know, I wanted to be Bertie Bruce so bad growing up, because he was the epitome of cool to me. You know, there's two people in cinema I always wanted to be. It was Bertie Bruce from Mallrats, and it was William Miller from Almost Famous. But that is a whole other podcast. So I've seen Mallrats for the first time. It blew my mind, and I immediately became a fan. But it got delayed a few years because I bought it on videotape. My mom was on the fence about buying said videotape for me, so she told my dad. My parents are divorced. They've been divorced since I was five. And I remember my mom handing the videotape to my dad, and my dad looking in the back of it and saw that Kevin Smith, who directed Clerks, directed this movie. And my dad had seen Clerks, and my dad's like, "Are you out of your fucking mind buying a movie from the guy who did Clerks?" And I remember later that night I went to bed and he watched it just to see if my mom was right, and I remember him laughing his ass off, and I'm like, yes, I'm in. He's gonna let me keep this movie because he likes it too. I remember on the way to school, I asked him. I was like, so, about Mallrats? He's like, you know, I'm keeping this. I was like, are you really buying a movie from the guy who did Clerks? Really? He's like, there's shit in that movie that made me shrieking. He's like, and you know me, I'll say anything. So let's fast forward to 2 years later. I'm in high school. High school sucks. I'm still a fat, awkward teenager, but I'm in the marching band. And the collector's edition of Mallrats came out on DVD. I still own this copy, and I'll never get rid of it. It's one of my all-time favorite DVDs that I own. And he gave me back the VHS copy. He's like, here you go. You bought the damn DVD. You can have your VHS copy back. And I'm sitting there. I was like, it kind of defeats the purpose. I have it on DVD. And this DVD is way more cooler than that VHS tape. So from there, I began a rabbit hole that lasted me 22 years. I revisit his filmography quite often, and it still brings me joy. So let's go through his filmography. It all starts with Clerks, which I saw, I think, right away after Mallrats, because I know I felt cheated that I saw Mallrats, but I didn't see Clerks. And Clerks is really just kind of a testament of anybody in their 20s. Anybody can relate to any aspect of that movie, you know? And it's a very important film. You know, people know it's important because that introduced us to Kevin Smith. But people, I don't think people really realize how important that movie is. I mean, it did so much for the landscape of cinema. It revamped comedy in my eyes. So it was released in 94. And prior to that, comedy was just kind of in a weird spot. The only things that I remember being released were like movies that had SNL cast members in it. And there was few SNL adaptations, you know, because Wayne's World really just jump-started that. It was a major success at the box office, so any chance the rights holders to SNL could do a movie, they did it. And because prior to that, I think the only adaptation they had had that was really successful was the Blues Brothers movie, which I'm surprised didn't offshoot more, you know, movies that featured SNL skits and whatnot. But they really didn't take the plunge until after Wayne's World was released. But what they used to do, and they even still do now, is like they would take a cast member, put them in a movie, and kind of test the waters like that. I mean, Eddie Murphy, Dan Aykroyd, Bill Murray, John Belushi, Adam Sandler, David Spade, Chris Farley, Norm Macdonald. I mean, the list goes on. So you had those. And then I remember the teen genre kind of got watered down. It was more or less PG-13 movies. And which is weird because in the 80s, it just seemed like every teen movie was an R-rated movie. I mean, they dabbled with the PG-13 rating at some point, but that was few and far between because the PG-13 rating came into existence, I think, in the mid-80s. And it was actually because of Steven Spielberg. He had done a couple movies, and the ratings board was like, oh, we're giving this an R. He's like, why? Like Poltergeist, for example. It's like, why? It's about a ghost in a family's house. There's nothing gory about it. There's no cursing. I mean, there's nothing just out of the ordinary. I mean, it's a scary ass movie. I made it, but why? So that right there prompted the PG-13 rating, just kind of have a good middle ground between PG and R. But teen movies, I remember that point, were PG-13. I think at that point the ratings board and like theater owners started to crack down on the whole age thing. It's just like, you know, you're 14, you shouldn't be seeing this rated R movie. So SNL movies, I'll just lop all that in the one, and then the teen movies were the only two that I remember being heavy hitters back in those days. And I remember there's a few that kind of seeped through that were rated R or didn't feature a SNL cast member, but it's kind of hard to sit down and think about it. So Clerks really prompt the whole raunchy comedy thing back into existence, because I remember a lot of movies with raunchy dialogue coming out after that. And it eventually gave birth to the gross-out genre towards the end of the decade with stuff like There's Something About Mary, American Pie, you know, stuff like that. So it was very important in that aspect. Not only that, but it was a huge, huge film for independent film, because independent film kind of was like a sleeper thing. The late 60s, early 70s, when the studio heads were retiring. I mean, we're talking people that built fucking dynasties in the film industry. All these great movies that were made up until the late 60s, you know, the studio heads at that time before the corporations came in and bought them out, they were responsible for. And they always had a formula that worked. And now with these corporations coming in, they weren't going on gut instincts. They were just kind of like, oh, we need test markets and shit. And Easy Rider, really prompted the whole, like, well, people want to see real movies. You know, they don't want, like, a epic drama. They don't want a musical. They don't want a Western. And then, of course, as far as Westerns are concerned, that whole genre changed with the spaghetti Westerns. And Sergio Leone was a huge catalyst for that. I mean, when he made fucking Fistful of Dollars for a few dollars more, and then The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, the fucking Western genre was changed. And even Hollywood even took notice. They're like, well, they really like these movies. I mean, they're unorthodox as opposed to, like, Westerns everybody's used to seeing. So that had a big influence. And then Easy Rider did. It's like, all people want to see, like, real movies, I guess, real gritty movies. So they made some, like, real pictures, I guess. I don't know a better way to describe them throughout the 70s. And the 70s is one of the greatest decades for film, hands down. I mean, every decade's great, but, like, you want to talk about how innovative the 70s were. I mean, we had The Exorcist, Dirty Harry, Taxi Driver, you know, throw Star Wars into there, Apocalypse Now. I mean, the list goes on. And it was all prompted because of Easy Rider. And then from there, these studio heads were looking at film schools and seeing the up-and-coming talent that was at these film schools. And it was so weird because we live in a time now where, like, a studio will see, like, an indie film, they're like, oh, we'll release this. We'll give you a picture deal, but we'll release this. Back then, it was just like, we want you to do what you did by yourself for us. And that's how guys like Scorsese and De Palma and Coppola got movie deals. And then independent cinema really just kind of became underground again, at least to my observation. And when I'm, you know, talk like this, I'm no expert. I'm just spitballing. So, and then, but exploitation movies were kind of like indie films. But, you know, it was kind of a sleeper thing during the 70s and then the 80s. And then in the 90s, it made a comeback. I mean, we were seeing more film festivals dedicated to indie films. We're seeing more press on these indie films. And it really changed the landscape of not only the market, but Hollywood in general. I mean, they were taking notes. And the 90s was just a crazy year for film. I mean, they were really just kind of reevaluating the situation in cinema after the 80s. They're like, okay, we want to go ahead, but at the same time, we want to keep a formula that's going to work. And indie film had no formula. I mean, you had these guys that either went to film school or didn't go to film school or went to film school for a little bit making movies, and they were really good movies. I mean, you had Reservoir Dogs, you had El Mariachi, and then you had Clerks. So Clerks was a very huge part of that movement, and it changed the landscape of film, especially indie film. I remember, and again, to my observation, you know, these major studios didn't want to dive into these indie films. So they created companies that just released indie movies. I don't know if MGM had one. I think they acquired Orion at that point. And Orion did some kind of low scale stuff. Great stuff. Paramount, I think Paramount had Paramount Vantage, I think that's what it's called. Universal had, like, Focus Features and, like, Working Title. But I think Working Title is a British company. I'm not too sure about that. Warner Brothers had one. I think Warner Brothers, like, indie film company came out of Trick or Treat. Trick or Treat's an anthology movie. I think it was made in 2005 or 6. They had a couple of test screenings, and they shelved it. And it kills me when a movie gets shelved for no good reason. It's just like, did you not think it was good, or did everybody think it was not good? But these people that happened to see a screening of Trick or Treat really just couldn't stop talking about it and really prompted Warner Brothers to release it. And that's how it came out. And I think that's how the Warner Brothers kind of, like, indie film company came about too. New Line was a indie company, and John Waters was one of the few indie directors that were still going strong in the 70s, but they became a bigger company throughout the late 70s and the 80s into the 90s. They eventually got bought by Warner Brothers, but they had one called Fine Line Features. So indie film was making a comeback. These studios know about it, and Clerks, we have Clerks, this thing for that. And Clerks is still a great film. Still holds up. You know, I love Kevin's approach to it. Black and white, that's a very cost-effective measure, and that's something George Romero did in the late 60s with Night of the Living Dead, because shooting a film is not cheap. I can't say enough about Clerks. It's still an amazing film. And what an introduction to cinema than Clerks. So Clerks became a success on the festival circuit. He ended up striking a deal with Miramax. Miramax bought it from him. and retooled it a little bit, released it very limited, and it made a profit. So there you go. He eventually ended up getting a deal through Universal to do Mallrats, which was his next movie. And Mallrats now is celebrated as love, but for the longest time, it was considered his sophomore slump. And that's something that I've seen indie directors succumb to. I mean, Richard Linklater is a huge example of that. Slacker. Richard Linklater Slatter. Ah, Slacker. Third strike, I got to take a sip of water. Richard Linklater's Slacker was another film that was a huge part of that whole 90s indie film renaissance. And kind of happened to him. He did Slacker, it got seen, he got a deal, and the movie he ended up doing, which on paper didn't do well, was Dazed and Confused. So Kevin was kind of facing the same trials and tribulations as a what would be now a second time director. The movie didn't do well. It didn't gross its budget back or anything. I think it made like $2 million from a $6 million budget. And for years, people kind of, you know, it had its fans. It had its small group of fans. Hell, you know, maybe the estimate was wrong about how many people actually loved this movie for the longest time, but it kind of had a rebirth on video. But Universal did a special edition, which in turn, years later, actually before the era release, there was a 10th anniversary edition, which featured an extended cut of the film. And I'm not a fan of the extended cut, but it was really interesting to see Kevin and Scott go back and re-edit it the way it was initially going to be. I mean, it's interesting to watch, but it's not my favorite cut. That's a movie I definitely wholeheartedly hold the theatrical version near and dear. So it's celebrated. People love it now. But back when it was released, that was not the case. Or at least that was the assumption. I mean, Kevin took the flop of Mallrats pretty hard. And he persevered through it, though. I mean, he went back to the drawing board, per se, and said, hey, how can I make my third movie even better? And what he did was he went back to basics. You know, he went back to being an indie filmmaker and made Chasing Amy, which is funny because Chasing Amy, had it been casted differently, would have had a way bigger budget. And Miramax is like, well, you can make it, but we want these people in the lead, not your friends. And he's like, well, I want to make it with my friends. So they gave him $250,000 to go make Chasing Amy. And the movie's phenomenal. It's a unique love story. You know, I haven't seen anything like it since or even before that. A very personal film. I feel all of Kevin's films are personal, but especially that one. And I feel like anybody that watches it is moved by it and takes something away from it. And there's some personal connections I do have to certain aspects of that film that eventually made me like a better person. So Chasing Amy is a success. Puts him back on the map, and he revolutionized indie film again. I mean, he did it with Clerks. He did it with Chasing Amy, and that's just awesome. I mean, he lightning struck twice for that dude. So from there, his career went back. You know, it kept on rolling, and he eventually made Dogma. And Dogma was a movie he was supposed to make or wanted to make after Clerks, but he couldn't find funding for it. But when Chasing Amy was a hit and reestablished him as a filmmaker, he got to make it. I just watched that a couple days ago. I forgot how genius it was. All the religious talk is lost on me because I am not religious. I was partially raised in a Lutheran household, so all the Catholicism stuff just went over my head, but it's still a great film. One of his best looking films, and the cast in it is just phenomenal. I mean, we got Ben Affleck, we got Matt Damon, we got Linda Florentino, we got George Carlin, we got Alan Rickman, Chris Rock, you know, Jason Mewes, you know, just the cast is just stellar. But as of this recording, I feel it's becoming a lost Kevin Smith movie because a certain person who I'll not name on this podcast has the rights to it, and he's not going to let go of those rights anytime soon. And I don't think people that can get the rights back want to. And, you know, that's, I respect that, and rightfully so. But I highly recommend watching Dogma, whether you have to watch it on YouTube or watch, you know, a pirated copy, or even spend $300 on a legit version, because that's how much they're going for. It's actually one of my pricier titles in my collection. I own it on VHS. I own the special edition DVD, which I absolutely just drooled over when I bought it back in 2002, 2003. And I also, you know, I'm fortunate enough to have the Blu-ray copy too. So check Dogma out. And I hope it doesn't become a lost movie, but for the time being, I can understand kind of why. After that, he made Jane and Silent Bob Strike Back, and I love it. I love it more now than I did back when I was 14. It's a pretty much a greatest hits compilation of the movies he made prior to this. You know, the references, the characters, you know, it's all there. And funny story, I remember seeing Planet of the Apes, the Tim Burton one. My dad took me and Jeff to go see it because we're a huge Planet of the Apes family. We love the original movies. I think my dad still likes the Tim Burton one. And of course the reboot that came after it, the reboot and the sequels that came after it. And I remember getting out of the theater and we got in the car. Dad's like, well, what do you think? Because prior to it being Tim Burton doing it, it was just kind of like folklore. It was like, oh, we're going to reboot the Planet of the Apes franchise again. We just don't know how. And there was so much press around that movie. Tim Burton shot so many endings. I don't even think we've seen any of the endings he shot. Maybe one. So we're in the car going home. Dad's like, what did you think? And I think Dad was like, oh, that was pretty awesome. And he's like, well, Andy, what did you think? I was like, I like the Jay and Bob trailer in front of it. He's like, you fucking would. So, but I bought it when it came out on DVD, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. Back to topic. And absolutely loved it. I liked it, but I was just like, yeah, you know, I own all of his other movies and those are kind of better. But when I got older, I really enjoyed it more. I actually watched a videotape copy of it a week or so ago, and I found myself laughing at it more now as an adult than I did when I was 15, which again says a lot about my maturity level. That's a very nostalgic film. Like, I remember, you know, when the movie was being made, the hype, the excitement about it, how much of a big deal it was, some of the fads and whatnot. It's a very nostalgic film and it's an amazing film. So after Jay and Bob, Kevin decided to kind of go out of the VSQ universe. And for those of you that don't know about the VSQ universe, it pretty much is the Jay and Silent Bob world. You know, Clerks, Mallrats, Chasing Amy, Dogma, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, Clerks 2, and even Jay and Silent Bob Reboot. Can we consider Jay and Silent Bob Super Groovy cartoon movie one? I don't know. I watched that once. I was like, yeah, it is what it is. So he decided to go out of this universe that he created, which was a pretty fucking bold move. And he did Jersey Girl. And Jersey Girl got a lot of shit because it wasn't a Kevin Smith movie. Finger quotations is what I'm doing right now. And it also had Bennifer in it. For those of you that don't know about Bennifer, it's the abbreviation that was used for the relationship that Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez had. I think they're together as of this recording. I don't know. I don't go to my mom's house frequently and read her Us Weekly, so I have no idea what's going on in Holly Weird. So, but Bennifer did... Okay, I don't like saying that. Affleck and Lopez did a movie called Geely that tanked. And I wholeheartedly believe that movie tanked, not because of their high-profile relationship at the time, because they were both A-listers. I think it tanked because it really wasn't that great of a movie. I mean, I watched the first 15 minutes of it and didn't like it. So, I mean, I personally just didn't like the movie. I could have cared less who was in it. So he does Jersey Girl after this, and he's, like, mortified. He's like, fuck, what if this movie suffers the same fate as Geely did? And it kind of did. But I enjoyed it. I still enjoy it. I've actually been watching it here again recently because, yes, I do own Jersey Girl. I own it on DVD and I own it on VHS. And it was funny. My dad bought me the DVD for Christmas one year and laughed. He's like, ha ha, I had to buy you Jersey Girl for Christmas. Ha ha ha. He still makes fun of me for it. But I enjoyed the movie. I really did. And it's funny. The first time I seen it, I spent a Saturday at the movies when it came out. It came out, I think, the same weekend the Dawn of the Dead remake came out, and I'll be polite about that when I'm not a fan. And Uncle Greg called me. He's like, hey, you want to see that Dawn of the Dead remake? I was like, hell yeah, man. And he was the one who introduced me to Dawn of the Dead, the original one. He's like, you got to see this Dawn of the Dead movie, man. It's the scariest movie ever made. You're going to love it. It's zombies and a mall and all this other shit. So we saw the remake and we were just laughing. during the entire time. I mean, that movie's so fucking ridiculous. Like, you can't do anything but laugh. And I do apologize for my listeners that are fans of the remake. I am not one of them. And I do apologize. I did love The Watchmen, by the way. And I did love certain aspects Snyder did with Man of Steel. But I seen that and was just disappointed and just didn't have any faith for Jersey Girl. And my mom met me at the movie theater and we watched Jersey Girl. Because my mom was a Kevin Smith fan. She watched all these movies with me and loved them. Not as much as I did, but she loved watching those movies with me and, you know, was a fan. And she was one of the reasons why I got to go to the Jay and Silent Bob Secret Stash in Red Bank, New Jersey. When I was 15 or 16, we took a family trip, not like vacation, to the East Coast. I got to go to the Dawn of the Dead Mall, and we went to the Jay and Silent Bob Secret Stash. Because unbeknownst to me, I had no idea my stepdad had family that lived in Jersey near there. And it was so funny. They're like, well, what are you guys doing in Jersey besides visiting us? And I was like, hey, I'm going to go see Kevin Smith's store. And I figured living in Jersey as long as they have, they would have known who he was. And they didn't. They're just like, oh, I went to Red Bank once, came back. Wasn't that exciting. So I went to the Jay and Silent Bob Secret Stash, and my mom let me go by myself. And it was so cool of my mom to just be like, I know how much this means to you. So you go in by yourself, experience it by yourself, and we'll come and get you. I went in and I was just like, holy shit, like the master, his works live here. I mean, there were so many props from the movies. I remember seeing the movie computer stand thing that was in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. I saw Buddy Christ, the statue, posters, the Bluntmobile. I was hoping Kevin or Jason would be there, and they weren't. And I did see Brian Johnson and or Steve Dave. Or Bry, however he's called, the guy in Comic Book Men, because they did shoot Comic Book Men at this particular location, and Walt Flanagan. I ended up meeting Walt Flanagan. I was too scared to talk to him because I knew who he was. I was like, dude, you're the Lon Chaney of the 90s. Like, what do I say to you? Again, Birdie Bruce. And my mom went to the cash register for me. I bought the Birdie t-shirt, and I bought a Snoogans hat, both of which I have lost with time. And my mom's like, hi, yeah, we've seen you in movies. Can my son take a picture with you? I was like, you were the guy in Mallrats saying, tell him, Steve Dave. He's like, yeah, Walt was a nice dude. And we got done taking the picture. He's like, where are you guys from? And my mom's like, oh, we're from Ohio. He goes, wow. He's like, we got a lot of out-of-staters here. He's like, that's awesome. He's like, enjoy your day. Super nice dude. So we went to go see Jersey Girl, and I absolutely loved it. It was the best movie I had seen that day. And I loved it because, you know, one of the things I love about my favorite filmmakers is when they do something different. They go outside of their comfort zone and they do something that's out of the ordinary for them. And Jersey Girl is a perfect example of that. I mean, it was a commercial movie, you know, and that was something Kevin didn't do. And it was phenomenal. I mean, the cast was great. The story was great. A totally underrated movie, you know, and I still love it. And I'm hoping to see the extended cut, you know, because Kevin talked about that he had to trim some stuff, and he showed it at one of his film festivals. I hope that sees a Blu-ray release, because I think the world needs to see an extended cut of Jersey Girl. And as far as Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez are concerned, they were pretty rock solid in that movie. And when I go watch a movie with A-listers, especially A-listers that had the reputation that they had at that time, I don't think about that. I'm solely concentrated on their performance in said film. And they were amazing, you know? So after Jersey Girl, he didn't take the failure of that too hard, and he gave us Clerks 2, which was amazing, and I could relate to even more because I had worked fast food at that time. Oh, I went outside of the mic. My apologies. I had worked fast food at that time. Actually, I had just quit my fast food job when that movie came out, and I was unemployed for 2 months by choice. Because I was that stubborn 19-year-old. It's like, I've worked enough in my life. I'm going to take the summer off. And, well, I eventually got a job. And I'm still happy to say I'm still at that place. But Clerks 2, like I said, I related to a lot more. Even though it was pretty much kind of a reflection of Kevin in his 30s. And when I watch it now, because I'm in my 30s, I always get on these tangents and I lose my train of thought, but that's the charm of the show. I could relate to it more because I'm in my 30s, you know, and some of the stuff that Dante and Randall are facing in their 30s, you know, I've faced, and it's just man, I just can't express it. I was like, man, you hit me in the feels again, Mr. Smith. Great film. I love how we went from the quick stop to movies. Movies became a reality. It just wasn't some brief thing in Dogma and Jane Song, Silent Bob Strike Back. It was just a real living thing. And our two heroes are now working there. And then they go back to the quick stop. That was just so sweet. I loved how it still had that independent aesthetic, like some of his early work did. And that kind of followed him throughout the rest of his career. He kind of stayed on that road. After that, he again went out of the Viewers universe and gave us Zack and Miri Make a Porno. I love that because at the time, Seth Rogen was doing Judd Apatow movies, and Apatow was like the king. He still is the king. He's one of my favorites as well. And Kevin kind of wanted to make an Apatow movie. And I think he did with Zack and Miri Make a Porno, but I think that got lost on people. And funny film. I cannot wait to watch this one again. Didn't do so well. It was a very controversial movie, I remember. I remember no TV stations wanted to air a TV spot with the word porno in it. So I think they may have made kind of cleaner versions of TV spots and whatnot. I remember when the DVD came out, I remember buying it, and I have actually own three copies of that movie. I got a copy of Zack and Miri, which just says Zack and Miri DVD, the one I bought the day it got released. And I got a Blu-ray, which says Make a Porno. And then I got the Blockbuster version that says Make a Porno. Because Blockbuster, I mean, they won't show anything too gritty, but fuck, they'll, you know, stand up to the censors and put a rental release version out that says porno on it. I still love it. I can't wait to revisit that. There again, the George Romero connection is very, you know, evident in this film. I mean, it's set in Pittsburgh. They go to the Moreauville Mall. The hockey team is the Moreauville Zombies. And I absolutely loved that because, you know, I've been a George Romero fan about as the same time as Kevin Smith fan. And it was just so cool to see those worlds just collide. And then, you know, Tom Savini makes a appearance in it. Very great movie. If you have not seen it, I recommend it. I do have a kind of funny story about this movie, seen in the theater. So me and my girlfriend at the time seen it the weekend it opened, but a couple weeks prior to that, we went to the Mid-Ohio Comic Con and met Jason Mewes. Jason, one of the nicest people you ever meet, he was signing autographs for free, which I guess was a foreign thing because everybody else that was like a celebrity signing was charging for autographs and a photo. I got to meet him, got something signed, got a picture with him. He was nice enough to sign something for my brother who couldn't be there that day. So a couple weeks later, Zack and Miri Make a Porno come out. We're sitting in the theater watching it, laughing our asses off. Like I said, it's a phenomenal film. I love the departures Kevin takes in cinema, and this was one of them. Because, you know, he has his own brand of comedy, but he was trying to branch out and try to make an Apatow movie. And I don't discredit him for that, because I love Apatow movies. Throat's getting dry. I gotta drink water. Not drinking Liquid Death like I normally do. So we're sitting there watching the movie, laughing our ass off. It's a great movie. Can't wait to see it again. And the ending scene where Jason Mewes walks out of the bedroom naked, we were just like, we just froze. And I remember turning to my girlfriend at that time and going, we met that dude. Okay. But that takes a lot of courage to do a nuded scene. So I don't discredit him from that. He's a braver person than I am. So hope I didn't spoil anything. So after that, he makes Cop Out, which was one of his few studio movies that he made. He made that with Warner Brothers. And he worked with Bruce Willis, who he worked on briefly in Live Free or Die Hard. And I absolutely loved Live Free or Die Hard. I'm a huge Die Hard fan, and I thought that was a really, really good one. And of course, seeing Kevin Smith in a Die Hard movie, dude, that's what dreams are made of. And he was pretty much playing an archetype of himself, which was really cool. But he had worked with Bruce Willis on that, and Bruce is like, hey, I like you. We should work together. And Kevin has a whole story about it on one of his Evening With DVDs, which I highly recommend checking out if you haven't. So he makes Cop Out, and it didn't do so well, and he didn't really have a good working experience with Bruce Willis. And I watched a YouTube video a couple days ago about him talking about Bruce Willis. And, you know, at this point, he had already had the heart attack. And, you know, Kevin's got this new lease on life, which I love. You know, I loved his approach to life prior to the heart attack. Now I love his lease on life now because he had a heart attack and he realizes time is precious. And that's a lesson we should all take away, not just because Kevin Smith had a heart attack, just in general. And he was talking about Bruce Willis and he started getting choked up. And the writer on Cop Out had lunch with Bruce Willis and was just like, man, I was kind of a dick during Cop Out. He's like, I really like Kevin Smith. That kid is talented, you know, and that really meant a lot to Kevin. Kevin got a lot of, got to bury a lot of hatchets with his heart attack. I mean, Bruce Willis and Lyndon Florentino, I guess, emailed him after his heart attack and they both made amends, if you will. But yeah, but I enjoyed it. And again, I have a funny story about seeing Cop Out in the theater. I went to the movie theater on a Sunday and I was like, fuck it, I got nothing better to do, I'll just stay here all day. I went and seen The Crazies, which is a remake of a Romero film. Weird how time repeats itself, history repeats itself. And I was like, I'll see Cop Out afterwards, I gotta support my boy. Watched The Crazies, I was like, eh, whatever, you know. And then I watched the original one years later, I was like, yeah, the original one's better. I mean, it's a Romero film, I mean, I'm biased. And then I seen Cop Out. I remember laughing my ass off, thinking it was great. I was like, the dude can do a studio film. This is amazing, but it didn't do so well. So his future making studio films, unfortunately, came to an end with that. And I loved it because it was like a buddy cop movie. It is a buddy cop movie. And, you know, Kevin grew up watching stuff like Beverly Hills Cop, Lethal Weapon. So for him to make a movie like that was an absolute joy because he talks about his dad. His dad took him to movies a lot. He's like, this is something my old man would have enjoyed watching, and it shows. It's a well done film. If you didn't like it the first time you see it, I highly recommend giving it another shot because it's really good, really funny, and that's another one I can't wait to revisit. So after that, he kind of goes back to the well. I hate saying that because it makes it sound so horrible, but you know, Kevin's strong suit is indie film, and he did that with Red State, and I'll tell you, Red State's the best movie he'll ever make. You know, I love everything in his filmography, but Red State is the best movie he'll ever make. It was such a fucking bold movie to make. It was brutal. It was not forgiving. I'm just in awe when I'm talking about it. And for those of you that don't know, Kevin Smith's Red State is not a comedy movie. It was kind of a horror satire kind of thing on the Westboro Baptist Church. And dude, man, like I said, it's not forgiving. It is definitely way out of Kevin Smith's comfort zone. I mean, the closest thing to a Tarantino movie Kevin will ever make will be Red State. And Tarantino even fucking took notice of that. He's like, shit, this is like something I would make. And he even showed it in his theater. But at that point, he had generated a lot of controversy, not only because the Westboro Baptist Church was protesting him at every roadshow stop, but I guess when he showed the film, I think it was at Sundance, he had an auction for it. I mean, just went off the fucking radar. And I was like, dude, that's bold. Because I've never been to one that when Kevin does something, I'm like, yeah, you shouldn't have done that. You're dumb. Or never, like, you know, turn the other way. I always stand up, you know, for Kevin. Because he doesn't do terrible shit. He does unorthodox shit when it comes to his art, but he's never terrible. So I heard about the auction thing that went on with this movie. And unfortunately, nobody bought it, which is a shame because I think a studio or production house could have done a lot with this movie. But, you know, the film speaks for itself. And like I said, it's the best movie Kevin will ever do. And it's one of my all-time favorites. You know, as far as the View Askew universe goes, Mallrats is my favorite. As far as, like, his films in general is concerned, it's Red State. And I remember watching that movie. I bought it on DVD. I should have went to a roadshow because I think he went to Clark State. I just watched an interview with him and they showed the tour dates. I think he went to Clark State, which is not too far from where I'm sitting right now. I should have just went. I did see Kevin Smith live, though, around this time. He did a Smodcast tour with Scott Mosier, and they made a stop at Studio 35, which is a theater in Columbus, and me and my brother got to see him. Didn't get to meet him, though. We tried. We went out back by his car, and theater employees are like, you can't be here, we don't want to scare him off. So I remember going back inside, I was talking to my brother, I was just like, oh my god, I got to see my hero in the flesh. And then all of a sudden I hear this guy go, this is a great fucking theater. And I turn around and Kevin is like walking by me, and I'm like, oh my god. And then my brother and I were just turned white. We're like, holy shit, like Kevin Smith just walked by us. I even brought my Mallrats VHS for him to sign. But I did meet Scott Mosier, the producer we both did. I shook his hand and I was just like, honored to meet you, because, you know, for the longest time in Kevin's beginning of his career, Scott was the backbone, he was the producer. So, Jay and Silent Bob's super groovy cartoon movie. Yeah, it was all right. You know, it was cool to see an animated movie of Jay and Silent Bob and all those characters, but I don't know if I'll be revisiting that one. I actually don't own that one. I don't know if that technically counts as a Kevin Smith movie. I mean, he directed it. I'm on his Wikipedia filmography page right now, and it states that he did, but maybe I should give that one. Or actually, no, I take that back. He just only wrote it. That's weird. That's just in his main filmography. I have to keep this open so I know where I'm at and where I'm going next. After Red State, you know, he made Tusk. And Tusk, my throat gets really dry when I talk really long. That's why I periodically take breaks to drink water. Tusk is an interesting movie. I mean, the movie came out of a podcast episode that him and Mosier did, and he made it. Interesting film. I guess you can consider it his second horror movie. I mean, you can consider Red State a horror movie, but you can consider Tusk one too. My brother and I went and seen that. Jeff and I went and seen that. And I remember leaving theater. I was like, what the fuck was that? He's like, I don't know. That was cool, right? I was like, I guess. I mean, I don't know. That's one I'm definitely going to revisit. I'm not a huge fan of it, but I will revisit it. But I do give him props for, again, going outside his comfort zone and doing something completely different creatively on a creative front. I love the fact that Johnny Depp was in it. I mean, granted, he's in makeup and you can't really tell, but I also love how he got Johnny Depp in it. So Johnny Depp's daughter is friends with Harley Quinn, which is Kevin Smith's daughter. And Kevin's not one of those guys that is just like, hey, I'm a filmmaker, we should work together sometime. And he even states that on a YouTube video I watched. I think it was for the Producers Guild. It's on YouTube, talking about how he got Johnny Depp. And he just, on a whim, was like, fuck it, I'll just send him a script, see what he says. And he did it. And he was so low-key and cool about it that just, like, I was like, man, that's the dude right there. Like, he had no entourage. He didn't want millions of dollars, his normal take-home pay, which I don't think they could have afforded on that. And he gave a hell of a performance, and that speaks a lot to his craft. So I can't wait to revisit that one. So after that, Kevin had this plan to make, like, a Canadian horror trilogy thing. I'm not too sure about it. I think it's like the Great White Trilogy or some shit. I should have read up on it before I did this podcast, but, you know, classic me, I don't do any research before I do these, which could benefit or harm me, but you be the judge. I don't think my audience minds, and I love you for that. Next came Yoga Hosers. I'm not a fan of that. Again, I need to rewatch that, but I do think it was cool that, again, he did something different creatively, and he got to make a movie with his kid. How awesome is that? And I think that was the real reason why he did Yoga Hosers. Not only to complete this trilogy, as of this recording, he's still trying to complete, but he got to make a movie with his kid. How awesome is that? And Johnny Depp is in that one too. And yet again, I do have to revisit that one. So this movie is his last movie that's out now. Jay and Silent Bob reboot. I was on the fence about it. I was like, I don't know, man. Like, I love Strike Back, but I mean, how the hell can you do that again? But my wife insisted that I go see it, and she bought tickets for Jeff and I, because the movie was shown in theaters around Jeff's birthday, so it was his birthday present. So we got to go, and it was amazing. I was in a theater full of people that were Kevin Smith fans. I got to experience that with my brother, who is a huge Kevin Smith fan like me. I'm taking full credit for introducing him to Kevin Smith, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. He, in a tasteful way, parodied the reboot culture that's coming out now. Because if you really think about it, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back and Jay and Silent Bob Reboot are essentially the same movie, but done in different times. I absolutely loved it. It was nice to see everybody again. What Kevin did with it was great. I got choked up when I saw Ben Affleck and Joey Lauren Adams again. I don't know what it was about me at that time, or even, like, I don't know what was going on with me, but I choked up. Like, I literally almost cried when they were on screen together for the first time in so many years. And then when Ben Affleck goes into that whole spiel about being a dad, man, that got me in the feels, as my wife says. Just super awesome movie. I'm glad he got to make it, you know. That was a fun one I got to revisit a couple days ago. And again, I almost got choked up seeing Ben Affleck and Joey Lauren Adams again. And then that speech with about Ben being a dad, Holden being a dad, excuse me. And of course, all the Batman references I just laughed at, you know, because, you know, Ben's a good sport. You know, he's going to take the piss on himself, so to speak, if even that's the proper way to word it. So Kevin, that's the last movie Kevin Smith has released. Clerks 3 is on the pipeline, and I'm surprised he's doing a Clerks 3, because I don't know. I thought what he had to say with those characters in that world, he said in Clerks 2. But like any great director, you need a trilogy. I mean, you already have a movie universe. You have all these other great movies that don't exist within that universe. And you need a trilogy within that. And he's going to have that with the View Askew universe. I can't wait to see it. I'm so happy that him and Jeff Anderson, who played Randall, patch things up and they're able to do it. I can't wait to see what he has to say about his 40s and life at this point. And that's one of the great things about Kevin's work, is when you're watching a movie, you're not only watching a great film, but you're watching a reflection of how he feels, like where he's at, and you get a sense of that. That's why his stuff's so good. It's so authentic. So I can't wait to see Clerks 3. It's supposed to be out sometime this year, and you bet your ass I would be buying a ticket and going to see that. Do I have any more Kevin Smith stuff to talk about? Honorable mentions, the Clerks cartoon. Absolutely love that. Sucks it only lasted 6 episodes. I'm surprised nobody's picked that up, but that might happen after Clerks 3. I always get good vibes about things to come after a Kevin Smith movie gets released. I love his Evening With DVDs. Huge fan of those. I watched the first one just nonstop when I was in high school. I am surprised that fucking DVD still works. He did a segment on this anthology movie called Holidays, which I might still be on Netflix. I'm not too sure. Great, great horror anthology. I am a little upset that I remembered it now doing the Kevin Smith podcast. I should have mentioned it when I was talking about anthology films. I think it was the Romero podcast I talked about it. That's a great one. He did a really awesome one. I think Harley Quinn's in that one too. Co-executive producer on Good Will Hunting. That's a great film. I think that's it. I mean, the dude was in Degrassi. That's another thing I wanted to talk about. I'm glad I scrolled by that. Kevin got me into Degrassi. I remember watching interviews with him, and he kept talking about this Canadian TV show called Degrassi High, and he like just praised it. And of course, Renee and Mallrats, Shannon Doherty's character, that was the only thing I was really missing from Reboot, but I think she was going through health stuff at that time and couldn't do it. And Renee wore a Degrassi coat, and I'm like, I gotta see this Degrassi show. So my dad, Jeff, and I moved back into town. We lived in the boonies for like a couple years, and we moved back into town, and the town I still live in. And dad got cable or satellite. No, it was satellite. My dad wasn't keen on cable, because when you lived in the boonies, you had to have satellite dish, because for some reason cable just wasn't an option. I should have my dad on here, have him explain that, or hell, maybe you could explain that. So he got satellite, and there's this channel with our package called Noggin. It was kind of like an offshoot of like Nickelodeon. And I was scrolling through the menu, and I seen this Degrassi show was on. I was like, holy shit. So I immediately told Jeff. I was like, dude, that Degrassi show Kevin Smith talks about is going to be on like later tonight. And we spent that first summer back in town watching Degrassi, marathons of Degrassi, and playing Tony Hawk Pro Skater 4. And I love that show. Like, man, it's just so brutal in its honesty. It's scary. I'm talking about the old ones. I mean, hell, even the modern ones, Degrassi, The Next Generation. I had to think about which show it was, because I only know off the top of my head Junior High and then Degrassi High and whatnot. And wow. And then we, of course, it's famous now because Drake was in it. But yeah, it blew our minds. I was like, dude, this show's great. No wonder Kevin Smith talks about it. And he ended up being on a few fucking episodes. How cool was that? I mean, Kevin Smith wasn't on Kenan and Kel, but to be fair, they had Ken Forhey, who played one of the main characters in Dawn of the Dead, who later became a fixture in Rob Zombie's movies. And then Coolio did the theme song. So yeah, Kevin Smith introduced me to Degrassi, and I'm still a fan of the older series, the Degrassi Junior High and Degrassi High. And I remember on one of those Evening With DVDs, he talked about he talked about obtaining them on video after he got like his first paycheck from Clerks. And they weren't for sale. Like, they were for sale for like a school, but they weren't for public sale. That's what I was looking for. I get flustered. And he said he spent $600 on them, and that's how he got to watch the entire series run. Because I guess he used to watch it on public access back in the day, back when he was a clerk. And the one thing I will never forget about him talking about watching Degrassi was the School's Out series finale. And for those of you that don't know, I think Degrassi Junior High and Degrassi High had like pretty much the same cast. Well, it was just going to eventually end because all the kids grow up and they're like, I don't want to be like 20 playing an 18-year-old. So they did this thing called School's Out. It was like this made-for-TV event. I think they only aired it in Canada. They may have aired it down here. I'm not too sure about that. But Kevin like built it up so much that when I eventually got Degrassi High on DVD, that was the first thing I watched before I rewatched the entire series run, because I had pretty much seen them all because of like reruns on Noggin. Because what Noggin used to do was like 9 o'clock, they would show The Next Generation, kind of played catch up, and then like 11:30 midnight would roll around, they'd play classic Degrassi. And man, School's Out blew our fucking minds. As Jeff and I both sat down and actually watched it, and we're like, holy shit, dude, what? And I highly recommend tracking down at least Degrassi High, the original series, just for School's Out. And fun fact, it was the first time on Canadian television, primetime television, somebody got to say fuck. And Snake had the honors. So I think I felt like I went a little bit too long about the Degrassi, but you got to give credit where credit's due. And thank you, Kevin. He was in Southland Tales, the Richard Kelly movie, because that was one of the things I loved about Kevin. He was a huge Donnie Darko fan. And when I discovered Donnie Darko at age 16, I was like, nobody fucking likes this movie but me, maybe like four people, maybe the people that made it. Like, you know, the fan base for Donnie Darko is very little. And then I went out and bought the director's cut DVD, and he did a commentary on it. He's just ranting and raving about it. I was like, holy shit. So that kind of prompted him to be in Southland Tales, which was the movie that Richard did right after Donnie Darko. And we're talking about bold movies here. That was a fucking bold movie, man. I mean, Donnie Darko's fucking weird. That's one of the reasons I love it. And that will be a future episode. I will need help on that one. But Southland Tales, bro, that's fucking eerie, man. I actually have the Arrow Blu-ray that features the theatrical version and the cans cut. I still need to get through that one. My watch list for Blu-rays, DVDs, and even my streaming services are plumb full, and that's on it. You don't know who he is. And the only way I found out was like on MySpace. He took a picture of himself because he plays like a general with no legs. That's how I found out. I was like, holy fuck, Kevin Smith's in Southland Tales. So I rewatched it again just to be like, there he is. Pretty much it. He does a lot of like cameo stuff. Fanboys was awesome. He was in it. I mean, obviously I love Fanboys because one of the main characters is a huge Rush fan, and I've actually been listening to a lot of Rush and watching Kevin Smith movies, so I'm like 14 again. It's crazy. Made a cameo appearance in The Force Awakens, and that was the other thing I thought was cool too, is Kevin Smith's such a huge fan of Star Wars, and he got to do a cameo, and it got to visit the set. I'm just like, dude, you're living every fanboy's dream, and that is awesome. I think the last thing I will say, and we could end this, I don't make any apologies for taking so long because he's one of my heroes, you know, and that's what we do on the show. We honor the greats, you know, we either are honoring the greats, I'm telling you about something cool I seen, or some movie that I really love, or me and another person really love. Malcolm Ingram, who was a very close friend of Kevin, still is, did a documentary about him called Clerk, and it's just amazing. It's a beautiful tribute to Kevin's career and just Kevin as a personality. I highly recommend tracking that down. That is definitely on streaming. So I think I'm done here. Thank you for tuning in. Sorry about the delay in between episodes. You know, life happens. You know, work's been wearing me down lately, and this was fun. I miss doing this, and I hope that, you know, I don't let life get me down, drag me down too much to where I'm like, I'll do it tomorrow and just prolong it. So thank you for tuning in. Until next time, everybody. See you.